Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.org.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In the 1980s, stay-at-home moms left home and poured into the American workforce. Having both mom and dad as breadwinners meant being able to move into the right neighborhood, buy the second car, and pay for juniors' college tuition. It should have been a blessing. Now a sobering reality has emerged, say my guests tonight, Elizabeth Warren, a bankruptcy expert, and Amelia Warren-Tiagi, a business consultant. Our mother and daughter, a research team, and co-authors of the new book, The Two-Income Trap, middle-class American families with two working parents, they say, expect to earn a good deal more than one-income families did decades ago, but very often do not. And millions of two-income households are going broke, paying higher mortgages and massive college tuitions. Today, the two-income household is not a luxury, but a necessity, with mom and dad both working full-time just to keep the family finances afloat and, in many cases, going bankrupt trying. Tonight on Point, the perilous state of two-income families in America. Are you and your spouse both working 9-to-5 just to keep the family boat from sinking? Are you more comfortable than your one-income parents were? Are you living the American middle-class dream or feeling the squeeze of the two-income trap? We're not taking any calls this hour, but you can get involved in the conversation online. Go to our website, onpointradio.org, and click on Forums. Joining me now from New York is Elizabeth Warren, professor of law at Harvard Law School. Good evening and welcome, Elizabeth Warren.
Hello.
Hi, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Also with us tonight from Culver City, California, is Amelia Warren-Tiagi, a Los Angeles-based business consultant. Good evening and welcome, Amelia Warren-Tiagi.
Thank you, Tom. Good to be here.
Great to have you. These two are mother and daughter. They are co-authors of the new book, The Two-Income Trap, Why Middle-Class Mothers and Fathers Are Going Broke. And I have to say, you got me in a sweat just reading it yesterday. It's a trap that an awful lot of people know or know someone who knows. But really, it's most middle-class Americans in many dimensions these days. But tell us, Elizabeth Warren, why is it that with two incomes, American households are not better off than with one?
Well, we thought it was going to be the case that two-income families would be the richest economic unit and be very secure. But what we discovered is that when a family builds a budget around two paychecks, they're in big trouble if either paycheck goes away. And a two-income family has two chances for someone to get laid off, two chances for someone to get too sick to work. In addition, the two-income family has no one at home to care for the child who gets sick, no one to care for grandma if she gets hurt. And that means they have no safety net, no backup. So if something goes wrong, someone's got to take off work and lose income, or they've got to hire a replacement to take care of that family member. These are families that, in a sense, are like race cars. They're speeding down the straightaway, and as long as everything goes okay, two-income families will survive. But if they hit even a small rock in the road, that's it. They veer off course, and they're headed for a crash.
And, Amelia, is that the trap, then, that once a family buys into being a two-income family, there's no going back? They're dependent on it. They're hooked, even though one of those incomes from disease or layoff or you name it can go away. Is that the trap?
That is the trap that many families find themselves caught in. But it isn't inevitable. There are things families can do to protect themselves. In the two-income trap, we suggest a financial fire drill that starts with the advice that no one else gives you. Don't cut out the frills. The secret to financial security is not to count pennies. It's fixed costs and committing those two incomes to the mortgage, committing both incomes to the health insurance that gets families in trouble. If you can earmark that second income for savings, for extras, for vacations, special things for the kids, you can count yourself relatively secure.
But that comes in the very last pages of the book, and by that time we've read an awful lot of pages of horror stories and traps and contortions that families get into. Elizabeth Warren, you're a bankruptcy expert. You've written a lot on it. You've seen a lot of families who get into it. And you write here that against all kind of intuition, it's two-income families very often that are the most vulnerable to bankruptcy.
In fact, I want to draw a sharper point on that. The two-income trap starts with one fact from the bankruptcy research. Having a child is the single best predictor that a person will go bankrupt. We thought that meant that families were just spending too much money, too much time at the mall, all those designer labels, $200 sneakers. Mm. So we dug into the hard numbers, and this is where the story really began to take on its special twist. The average family, mom, dad, two kids, now spends less on clothing than they did a generation ago. We turn to food, you know, with mom at work, more fast food, more restaurant meals, fancy things like designer water. But it was the same kind of story. Today's families are spending less than they used to.
Wait, less on food, less on clothing than in
when? Does that knock you over?
Than
they did a generation ago.
So we're talking in the 1970s, let's say?
That's right. We compared the four-person family, a mom, a dad, and two kids, in the early 2000s, and that same-size family, a mom, a dad, and two kids, back in the early 1970s. And what we discovered was that today's family is actually spending less, inflation-adjusted, than their one-income parent was spending just a generation ago when they were raising their families.
On clothing or right across the board on necessities?
No, I'm sorry. Less on food, less on clothing, less on furniture, less on appliances.
Now, how can that be? We've got all these gourmet shops these days. We've got all the fancy brand name clothing. We've got stainless steel refrigerators, you know, side by side.
Well, you know, there are a lot of pieces to the story. Partly it's because we're focused here on median income families. And there's no doubt that the rich are buying a lot more than they did a generation ago. But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about ordinary median income families, people who are out there earning at the average. The second part
is... Put a dollar figure on that, Elizabeth Warren, if you would.
Oh, I'm not sure that I can. Amelia, can you help me out?
Median income families, so what range are you looking at?
These are folks who are earning $40,000 to $75,000 a year would be a typical middle income family.
Okay, so right in the middle of the American middle class today.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. And they're spending, this is the key, they're spending less on food. And you know, you pause for a minute, it actually makes some sense. They're not buying steak like they used to. They're buying in bulk. We have all the big discount stores mm-hmm. now. And so the inflation-adjusted cost of food for an ordinary family of four has actually gone down. Same sort of thing with clothing. Yeah, we see all those designer labels, but the truth is clothing has gotten cheaper and people don't dress as much as they used to. Let me guess what you have on right now, right? Business casual. You know, you don't wear suits
Hello, khaki.
5 days a week. That's
you
exactly
got that right.
Right. That's exactly right. You don't dress the same way. I used to buy for Amelia and her brother leather shoes. We had a pair for Sunday, a pair for school, and a pair of sneakers. You know,
I remember those trips to the shoe store many decades ago now.
That's right. Now, Amelia, tell me about the shoes for your baby.
My two-year-old owns one pair of $5 sneakers I bought her at Walmart.
And we all know that. And for many years, that's just about all kids need. And, of course, styles change. And now they wear them to the wedding or the church or whatever. But, Amelia, okay, so we may have to come back to this because I know a lot of people think, well, the reason people are in trouble these days is because their expectations have risen so high. They're living high on the hog, whatever you may say. We may have to test that. But I was fascinated here by what you're pointing to as the fundamental reason why two-income families aren't better off is that when everybody's got two incomes, they start bidding against one another for the things they most need. Describe that dynamic for us, Amelia.
You see it first and foremost in homes, in the shrinking number of school districts that have managed to hold on to good reputations. Parents want the best for their kids, and today that means starting off life with a good education. As parents' confidence in those public schools have slipped, they've bid against each other. And today's families now can bring two incomes to that bidding war.
And they're bidding to be in communities with decent schools, with schools that are considered good.
That's right. Good places to raise kids, good schools. in the past 30 years, the average mortgage expenditures for a family of four have grown 70% adjusted for inflation. Now, to put that in perspective, the average father's income has grown less than 1%. The only way to make up that difference is to send mom to work and to commit her paycheck to helping out with the mortgage.
Up 70% while dad's paycheck is up 1%, so it literally has to be the mother's, or the second paycheck anyway, that's keeping the household together. You also point, and you say that's all built around this urgent desire to be where there's a decent education for kids, and because the public school system is not anything like uniformly good, it puts a premium on getting into a few communities. You also look at the cost of childcare and education itself, Amelia.
Take a look at universities. Over that same time period, the tuition at the average public university, I'm not even talking the private universities, has nearly doubled adjusted for inflation. Again, the average dad's income didn't go up at all. The only way to make that difference up is to take on a lot of debt or to commit mom's income to it.
And Elizabeth
and
Warren,
take a look.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I was just going to say, and take a look at preschool, the other end of the spectrum. Do you realize that in half the states in the United States today, a year's tuition in preschool costs more than a year's tuition at the state university? Families have 18 years at least to save up for university costs. They've got 3 years to save up for tuition in preschool. Families are getting slammed by these expenses.
Slammed right from the start. I mean, it ends up being a pretty scary picture that you draw. And Elizabeth, your specialty is bankruptcy. You point straight at that and how easily people end up there. I think people who haven't brushed bankruptcy often think that it's something that lives far away from them. Just how close and how easily can bankruptcy end up on the door of a middle-class, two-income family?
Well, let me put it this way. This year, more children will live through their parents' bankruptcy than will live through their parents' divorce. In other words, bankruptcy is becoming more common among the middle class than is divorce.
And you also said, if I remember correctly, more people will go bankrupt than will go to college. Did I get that right?
Then we'll graduate from college.
That's exactly right. That's another astonishing way of looking at it.
Or let me give you another way. More people will file for bankruptcy this year than will be diagnosed with cancer. And the point of this is to say cancer, college, divorce, these are the things that are the warp and woof of American life. Our point is bankruptcy is part of that warp and woof of middle-class life today. The difference is, in the case of bankruptcy, no one talks about it. You have as many neighbors who've gone bankrupt as you do neighbors who've gotten divorced. But the trick is, you'll know about the divorce. You won't know about the bankruptcy.
How does it happen? What triggers it?
Well, mostly now, it's that families are so pressed to the wall on a day-to-day basis. They are committed to huge fixed expenses. So that if something goes wrong, there's no place to trim. It's not possible to trim down your mortgage payment by 15% or to cut back on your health insurance by 50% or to stop making every other car payment. Those are big fixed expenses. And that means when something else goes wrong, and I can tell you the three, it's jobs, medical problems, and divorce. Mm-hmm. If a family gets hit by any of those three, it's already right at the breaking point, and it doesn't take much just to break them.
So they've got the two incomes. The number may look good, at least on paper, but it sounds like the littlest puff of wind can blow the whole thing over, Amelia.
I think that's right. But I don't want to scare everybody out there.
Well, it's not like people haven't, as long as they don't know it, everybody's living it, or an awful lot of people are.
Well, that's true. And it's the story of my generation and how things have changed between my mother's generation and my generation. In her generation, people bought a home on one income and never thought twice about it. And they didn't worry and stay up at night worrying about where they were going to send their children to public schools.
They just walked down the street and went to school.
It was that simple.
Do you feel ripped off, Amelia, being in the generation that got to have all this? I mean, your mother's generation, you know, went to work so that you could have a job and could have two incomes, and now, oops.
I think there are a lot of women who feel that they are working harder than their mothers did and getting less for it.
Amelia Warren Tiagi, hold the thought. Elizabeth Warren as well. We're talking tonight about the startling financial perils of the two-income household in America today with the authors of the new book, The Two-Income Trap. Are you in the trap, the two-income trap? Can you feel it? Are two incomes a luxury or a necessity in your household? And could you stay afloat if one income went away? Are you sure? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the startling financial perils of the two-income household in America today. My guests are Elizabeth Warren and Amelia Warren Tiagi, mother and daughter, a bankruptcy expert and a business consultant, and co-authors of the new book, The Two-Income Trap, Why Middle-Class Mothers and Fathers Are Going Broke. You can join the conversation. Can you believe the whole country's gone to work, men and women, and is no better off? Are people cash poor now because they spend too much on goodies, or are middle-class households really struggling to cover the essentials? Listeners, get into the conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on Forums. Tony's calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Hi, Tony. You're on the air.
How are you doing, Tom? Hello, Amelia. Hello, Elizabeth.
Hi. Great to have you.
Hello.
How are you? I seem to be living the middle-class experience right now. Everything you said, I pretty much experienced it to some degree.
Two-income family, Tony?
Two-income family. For a while, I was living away from where family, or no, the extended family was located, and that was just way too expensive, but I was in the military at the time.
Right.
With a young daughter. But now I'm back with the extended family, and whoever survived, you know, people have passed along the way, but now I've got a 21 and a 17-year-old.
And how are you finding it? You've got two incomes coming in, and
right.
Does it begin to cover? And if it doesn't, is it because you're living the high life, Tony?
Let me put it this way. I'm about ready to lose my battery because I haven't had the money to buy a new one yet for my phone. So if I drop, it's not because I hung up on you. No, we still have a lot of the, tide-me-over furniture. We haven't bought a new furniture suite in a long time.
Mm-hmm.
We don't live extravagantly. We live in a small ranch 2.5-bedroom house. I'm fixing the basement bedroom for my daughter. Right now, we just don't have the means to buy a new house.
Even though your wife's working, how does your wife feel about the fact that she's worked, I guess, also, but you guys haven't managed to get up out of a kind of hand-to-mouth life?
Yeah, well, it's we're looking ahead. We do have a plan. It's just slow moving. That's about it. We're living in a part of the country where it's not much is happening anytime soon, like the rest of the country, I'm sure, right now. But basically, I see a lot of our money going toward education for our daughters because we want the best for them.
Sure.
Try to find experiences. If we're going to do something special for the summer, we'll try to find a way to enhance their cultural enrichment, you know, experience. Plus, I went to school for changing of my career.
Right.
Because I saw the water hole dry up, and I made a move to something I loved all my life anyways.
So do you feel like you're in a kind of trap, this kind of two-income trap that our guest described tonight?
I'll tell you, let me try to visualize it this way. In one hand, a family has a bag of groceries. In the other hand, they're going for this golden ring. Now, if you're reaching for that golden ring too hard, or the harder you reach for it, it seems the looser your grip gets the bag of groceries that'll sustain you now.
And the golden ring is somehow to break out of the hand-to-mouth, to really get ahead.
Well, it seems like the American dream. We want the American dream for ourselves and for our children, especially for our children.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just, you know, I'm just kind of sitting back here looking at the big picture, and that's what it seems to me. Myself included, we want the best for our kids, so a lot of our finances go in that direction. And the more we try to, you know, reach for that, like you mentioned earlier, my mom's generation, you know, when she stayed at home and, you know, went to school in the neighborhood, I wasn't bused anywhere, really.
Mm-hmm.
Walked home for lunch. It was a pretty relaxed lifestyle. But everyone seems to be very nervous these days.
Tony, we've got it, and we hear it in your story. Thanks for painting that picture. Thanks for calling. Elizabeth, Amelia, this is the story that you've heard again and again as you wrote the book, and this feeling of living on that knife's edge, which Tony's got right there. But you really point at kids as a factor. Everybody just assumed a generation ago they would have them and they'd fit into the family budget. Now you look at children as budget busters. It's kind of a sorry way to look at children, but that's what I'm reading right here in black and white, Elizabeth.
No, not quite. Not quite.
Well, to the extent that you're warning that we may face a future where people stop having kids because they just don't fit into the family budget anymore.
But it's a warning because that's the thing that scares me worst. It's not because it's what I want. Listen to what Tony said. He talked about the dream for his children. We wrote this book ultimately as an act of optimism, a belief in the middle class, and mostly a belief in middle class parents who love their children and are doing the best by their children. Mm-hmm. And the reason we wanted to focus on this is to say that this whole notion that the reason families are in financial trouble is because of overconsumption is a myth. It's a shibboleth. It's a distraction. And it's a way to say to families, you know, if you're in trouble, it's your fault. And besides that, a way to say to families, to lull them into a sense of false security. If they're cooking their own pasta and buying in bulk and not eating a lot of restaurant meals or buying $200 sneakers, then they say to themselves, we must be safe. Mm-hmm. What this book is about is to say you're looking in the wrong place. The place you've got to look is in the other direction, and that is at the fixed costs. American family budgets have changed, and the proportion that is dedicated to fixed costs, to things that can't be easily downsized, and that now take two incomes to support, has changed. And if you don't know that going in, you can't play the game smart. This book is not about shaking a finger at people and saying, well, you're just all in a mess and never going to get out. It's about how to be smarter.
But how do you get away from a big fixed income? I mean, you lay it right out there. Families want to live in communities where their kids can go to decent public schools. Once mom gets a job, she's got to have a car very often to get to that job. Right there, you've got two big fixed costs, a mortgage and a car payment. And then college comes trundling down the rails. What's the solution?
Absolutely. Well, there are a lot of pieces to the solution. One part is to focus on families who are not in financial trouble. And that is to say, now's the time to take the financial fire drill. And we give a lot of details for how to do that in the two-income trap. It starts with advice no one else gives you. Don't cut out the frills. The secret to financial security, in part, is not to count pennies. It's to focus on those fixed costs.
Easy to say. So you're saying you can still go out to dinner, go to the movies, live it up, have some fun, but don't have a big mortgage payment and don't have too much of a car payment. But how does anybody avoid that when they're trying to accomplish what every family wants to accomplish, some comfort and security for their kids and a good education?
Amelia, you want to step in?
One of the proposals we put forward in the book is a radical change in how we think about school assignment policies in this country.
So there's a public policy piece to this.
And there you're is saying, a public policy piece to this.
What, you can't unhook the trap unless you fix public education across the board?
You can't unhook the trap unless you unmarry zip codes from quality of schools. Right now, families don't decide where their kids go to school. Bureaucrats decide where their kids go to school. And the only way the average family can make a choice is to up and move to another part of the city. We propose metropolitan-wide school choice, whereby parents could choose any public school in the area for their kids so that parents take control of the schools.
And your idea here is that then parents wouldn't feel bound to get into this particular neighborhood or this particular town because their children could go to school anywhere that's nearby.
Well, it's not
only
they wouldn't feel
right.
bound, it wouldn't make any difference. The whole notion behind this is children should have access to public schools based on their interests, based on their talents, based on their test scores, based on lotteries, based on anything besides whether their families can afford to buy a $50,000 home or a $500,000 home, that basing access to educational opportunity on whether or not your parents can afford a very expensive home is not about public education. That's just a new form of private schooling.
What's going to make that happen after all these two-income families have fought tooth and nail to get into the community where they want to live, to have their kids going to school there, and suddenly they're going to be told, hey, you know what, the kids from next door where the houses are $50,000 instead of $250,000 are going to be taking up chairs in your school. Where's the political constituency that's going to vote that one open?
Well, I actually think parents are the... I'm sorry. Go ahead, Amelia.
Amelia.
You're assuming parents are happy today with the kinds of educations their children are getting. And I think there are a lot of parents who aren't happy. If you said to parents, you get to choose, even parents who already live in good school districts, you say you get to choose a school that's suited to your child. Perhaps you have a child who'd do better in a smaller environment. Perhaps you have a child who'd do better in a school that offers more after-school activities. Schools would have the opportunity to differentiate themselves, not trying to be all things to all students, one size fits all. And parents could be in the driver's seat, selecting and shaping the schools for their children.
It's an ambitious plan, but you're saying you've got to be ambitious to unlock this trap, to keep people out of the bidding war, to be in just a few little towns. Let's take some more calls. We have a lot who want to join us. Fran's calling from Newburyport, Massachusetts. Hi, Fran. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. How are you?
Great, thanks.
Well, in terms of talking about the crunch, a very, very big percentage of our two incomes goes into paying for education. I guess, you know, one way to look at it is we did get into a private school situation for our children.
So you've been paying for a long time.
I'm sorry?
So you've been paying for a long time for education.
Yes, and I mean, I can't expect anybody to feel sorry for me. We opted into that. Both my husband and I are public school products, and we assumed when we had kids they would go to public school. But my older daughter wasn't really happy in the public school, and, she wanted to try a private school, and we said, well, we didn't know how we were going to finance it, but we said, well, we'll let you go ahead, and if you get in and we can afford it, we'll make a go of it.
And the bills came right along behind. Where are your daughters now, Fran? Are they college or still?
They're in college, and both of them. We thought that the most important investment, if we were going to be going the private school route, mm-hmm. Which surprised us that we agreed to do that, but we thought, well, we'll invest in their high school education, and then they will have a solid foundation for learning. They'll have a love of learning. They'll have the skills, and then they'll move on to college. And we were thinking that the high school education was probably the most important formative, education.
So where has that left your financial landscape now, Fran?
It's left it very, very hard to save. In fact, in terms of, retirement income, well, we all have been hurt by,
the market the last couple
of
years.
We all have been hurt by that.
Do you have savings for retirement? If they're in college, you must be beginning to think about retirement.
Well, we have some savings for retirement, but it's not going to be enough. And we're so overloaded with education debt because I'm paying a school loan.
Oh, boy.
I had to go back to school because I had to retrain. So not only will I have my children's, but I'll have my own. I still have my own. And so, we've consolidated some of the debt, but we'll be paying education loans, probably, close to the retirement years if we can retire.
So two incomes and the trap is absolutely something you know very well. Fran, thanks for calling and thanks for sharing that story. Amelia, there it is again. Just the kind of box that you're talking about, people having constructed around themselves. But not easy to avoid. Maybe private school you can get away from, but then they were worried about the education.
Absolutely. And I tell you, my heart goes out to Fran. She's doing what millions of families out there are doing, which is doing the best she can for her children. And one of the reasons we wrote The Two Income Trap was to shine a spotlight on the real reason families are struggling. As long as we hold on to the myth that, well, if families like Fran's don't have enough for retirement, it's because they took too many vacations to the Bahamas, then it isolates those families. It leaves them filled with blame and nobody out there trying to help them.
And feeling alone with their own problem there.
That's right. And these kinds of shows show family they're not alone. That's our first thing we say to families who are struggling. Nearly 1 in 7 decent, hardworking, play-by-the-rules families is in financial trouble. and they're in financial trouble because they're doing the best by their families or because they were hit by a stroke of bad luck.
Now, your book
not
is also
bad or foolish people.
Your book is also very critical of the lending industries, of banks and lenders, and regulations governing them that you say are kind of stacked against middle class America. How's that work?
The credit card industry needs to be reined in. Virtually every civilized nation on earth has had usury laws in effect. Those are the laws that regulate the interest rates you're allowed to charge on debt. They've had them in effect since the times of the Bible. But America quietly got rid of its usury laws in the early 1980s with virtually no public debate.
So there's no limit on interest rates?
That's right.
But everybody knows you shouldn't rack up credit card debt. I mean, that's just basic common sense if you can possibly avoid it, right?
Of course families should be savvy about debt, and we want to help families to get the information they need. But let's be honest. I have an MBA from Wharton and several years' experience in financial analysis, and
yep.
I don't understand the terms on my credit card.
Well, but you understand that a big load of credit card debt is not what you want to carry.
Well, but wait a minute. It's not just about a big load of credit card debt or mortgage debt. Look at it the other way around. Today in the United States, you cannot buy a toaster that has a 1 in 10 chance of burning down your house. But because of deregulation, today you can take out a mortgage that has a 1 in 10 chance of costing you your house. Either way, the family's out on the street.
Meaning you can't afford that mortgage.
It's not just a question of affording them. Mortgages are written today, and credit cards are written today, to trick people. They are deliberately designed to load in, not all of them, but the ones that are what are called subprime debt.
Mm-hmm.
They're moving in on families, and they are draining literally tens of billions of dollars out of their pockets.
And you write that two-income families are particularly vulnerable because when they get up against the wall, they have to borrow. If somebody loses a job, somebody gets sick, they turn to that credit card, and it's the thing that comes back and bites them fast.
That's exactly right. This is the perfect storm. This is families pressed to the wall financially. Something goes wrong, and there is now an unregulated credit industry that circles them like sharks and is ready to pick them off. And these families are becoming shark bait.
Shark bait does not sound too good. What's your advice on that front? I mean, once people are pressed to the wall, where do you go but to wherever you can find the cash to try and tide over till the next job comes?
Well, let's do this both ways. We can talk about the individual family and what it can do, and we should also talk about government regulation and the importance of re-regulating the credit
industry. Well, let's look at government first. We'll come back after a break and look at personal strategies here. But on the policy front, what do you say?
Actually, this is the easiest one possible. With one sentence in a federal law, Congress could reinstitute usury rates. We could make them so they adjust for inflation, that is, tie them to something like the T-bill, and say that credit card companies and mortgage companies are allowed to lend way above the rates the inflation rate, 10 points, 15 points, but they can't charge 200% interest, 400% interest, 1,000% interest, as they are doing in some kinds of loans today.
So put a cap on it right now to help out people who fall off that two-income high wire. We're looking at the financial perils of the two-income household in America today with Elizabeth Warren and Amelia Warren-Tiagi. Their book is The Two-Income Trap, Why Middle-Class Mothers and Fathers Are Going Broke. What do you think? How big a hit could your financial balance take without tipping into bankruptcy? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking tonight at the startling financial perils of the two-income household in America today. My guests are Elizabeth Warren, bankruptcy expert and professor of law at Harvard Law School, and Amelia Warren-Tiagi, a business consultant in L.A. area. They are mother and daughter and co-authors of The Two-Income Trap, Why Middle-Class Mothers and Fathers Are Going Broke. Could you stay afloat if one income went away in your household? Are you sure? And does it make you mad that everyone's in the rat race and no one's home with the kids? Ned's calling from Boston. Hi, Ned. You're on the air.
How you doing?
Pretty good.
Well, my point is I am a young man who's just recently had a child and am married. And I own my own home. And
lucky
coming
you.
From this, I'm sorry?
Lucky you. Good for you.
Yeah, well, I think that the bottom line in my situation and a lot of people that are in my situation is that you need to be honest and smart about what you're doing. And in today's market, and in this area, it's very hard to find a home for under $300,000. And the income level that your guest had mentioned that was middle income, let's take the high end of that, which is $80,000.
Okay.
If you make $80,000, you bring home somewhere in the area of $4,000 a month.
Yeah.
Now, a $300,000 home with 10% down, you're looking at about a $2,000 a month mortgage.
And there's half gone right away.
Right, and then you throw into that child care. That's another $1,000 a month. I'm a school teacher, and to bring my child to my school and have it taken care of there would cost me $1,000 a month. Right there, that leaves you with $1,000 for every other thing. Now,
we know how many other things there are. Is it adding up in your case, Ned? Are you making ends meet?
Well, I'll tell you what. My wife was in the whole .com craze and was laid off in April of last year. And I did what I kind of see what a lot of my parents' generation did was that they said, I want my wife or the mother to stay home, and I, as the man, will do what I have to do in order to make ends meet. And right now I'm driving home from my second job. I also own a construction company, and that's what I have to do. I think that I could make it work if I cut corners and lived very frugally, but honestly, I don't want to do that.
So it's a two-income household still, but you're having to work two jobs to produce those two incomes. Ned, thanks for calling. Amelia, is a one-income life possible anymore?
It's very difficult. I like to think of it as everybody else out there is boxing with both hands, and the one-income families are trying to box with one hand tied behind their back. It isn't easy. One thing, though, that one-income families have that they don't realize they have is they do have this safety net. So if you can manage, to all the families out there who are thinking about, can we make it, can we not make it, if you can manage on one income and keep yourselves out of debt, you can play it a little bit tighter than the two-income family can.
And the safety net is just that someone's at home to take care of the children, someone's at home who could go to work if a crunch comes.
All of the above. Someone's at home mm-hmm. who could go to work if something happens to your job. Somebody's at home who could take care of a family member if somebody gets sick. That is a safety net that has real financial value. It's, in effect, an insurance policy.
It's of course, it was a reality a generation ago. People worked hard to get away from it. Now, it may be looking good sometimes. Lynn's calling from Manchester, New Hampshire. Hi, Lynn. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Great, thanks.
Hi, Elizabeth and Amelia. Your book sounds very interesting, and I'm calling to mention that my husband and I own our home, and I stay home with the children, and he works. He also goes to school in Boston a couple nights a week, and we're managing quite well.
On one income?
Yes.
How do you do it, and why do you think you can do it if so many two-income families we're hearing tonight are having so much trouble?
Well, I'm very frugal. And I learned lessons from my parents, and my husband learned from his parents. We always had what we needed growing up. We did not always have what we wanted. And I think that's a difference that many parents don't make the distinction between today when it comes to their children.
So you're saying too many Game Boys, too many extra pairs of sneakers.
Well, yes. I do think it's kind of a vicious cycle. When they're working all the time, and both the mother and the father, they tend to purchase things to make up for that. Maybe they're guilty. They feel guilt.
So you're not buying. I mean, you still see some kind of overconsumption as a problem for two-income families if it's not working out.
Yes, I do. And I do think that more people should try with having one parent stay home. I do think it's very doable. And
Lynn, if I may ask, how does your household feel compared to the homes of your two-income friends?
Oh, we are so relaxed. We have time to you know, color and play with clay, and nothing is rushed around here. I have a 6-year-old and a 3-year-old. We are never rushed. We are never, you know, in a hurry. We have dinners. We sit down and eat meals. I cook mostly from scratch, so we're not always, you know, eating out because that's the only thing we have time for. We're very relaxed, and even with my husband, he has a commute from Boston. He doesn't get home till 6:30 usually. Even with him getting home at 10 after his classes, we always have time for each other.
Well, it's hard to put a price tag on that. I can hear millions of two-income families' teeth grinding.
You know, we made less money when I worked because we both worked in Massachusetts, and the extra taxes and the extra vehicle and what would it would cost for daycare for the children would have eaten it up.
Lynn, we've got it. And everybody who's in your situation, well, if it's working out that well, great for them. And if they're working both two jobs and still sweating it to make it meet, Elizabeth, it must be a lousy feeling to look out and see, well, why can't we have that leisure?
I think that's exactly right. One of the parts when we were putting this book together, you know, there are more than 2,000 families that were interviewed and we collected data on in order to put this book together. And it was the number of families we talked to who said they thought they were the only ones. They were the ones who were in big trouble. In fact, do we have a minute that I can tell you a quick story?
Yes, please.
I want to tell you about Ruth Ann and James. They're the people who opened the book and actually one of the first couples that we talked with. They both went to college. She was an accountant. He managed a floor covering store. You know, it's the classic story. They met. They fell in love. They got married. They saved a little money. They mm-hmm. bought a small house. They had two kids. Life was good, and the bottom fell out in their lives in one day. The company closed the store that James was managing, and there was just no job. And they scrambled around, and they took extra jobs, and they spent down their savings, and they fell behind on the car payments and the mortgage. And James still couldn't find full-time work. About 6 months after this started, Ruth Ann came into the living room one afternoon to find her 7-year-old on the phone with a bill collector who was hassling the crying boy about a $55 credit card payment. Mm-hmm. Ruth Ann decided that was enough. The next day they went to see a lawyer, and a week later they filed for bankruptcy. But the part of the story that sticks with me is what Ruth Ann said about the day she filed for bankruptcy. She said she was driving down the street in her small suburb where she lives, and she was looking at all the well-tended lawns, the bicycles on the driveways, the basketball hoops, and she wondered, what's wrong with my family? Why did we end up losers when everyone else is doing just fine? And she said that as she pulled into her driveway, it occurred to her that from outside, her house looked like everything was fine, too, only it wasn't. This story, the stories we tell in this book, are about how things are not fine. Behind the doors, the yards look good and everyone smiles, but there's a lot of trouble out there. There are a lot of families who are in deep, deep trouble. And we wrote this book, dedicating it to Ruth Ann and James and to all the families like them, who work hard and who play by the rules and who are doing the best they can. We tell their stories. We try to explain the system that is conspiring against them, and we try to show them how to strike back.
And if you want that core piece of advice that comes out of the book, it's keep your fixed expenses low, that mortgage, that car payment, everything that's going to take a long, long time to pay off. Keep that expense low, and you guys say on the other side, have some fun. Live a little with it, with the income that saves. Don't buy the biggest house anymore. That turns around a generation of advice. Buy something smaller. Keep it modest. Keep your sanity and maybe keep a little bit more relaxed and maybe make it out of that two-income trap. Elizabeth Warren, Amelia Warren-Tiagi, mother-daughter, co-authors, I want to thank you for being with us tonight, and thanks for the story that your book tells.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The book is The Two-Income Trap, Why Mothers, Middle-class mothers and fathers are going broke. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, why finding a new job is as tough as finding true love. This is On Point. Thank you. Even with the recent growth in economic activity, the nation's unemployment rate remains right around 6%. Meanwhile, the number of unmarried adults, including divorced and widowed, is at an all-time high of 46%. Whether you're in the running on Monster.com or Match.com, the competition is stiff out there. The search for a job and the quest for love produce the same anxiety, says writer Scott Crady in this radio diary. He finds little pity in the HR offices or the dating games of New York City.
It was following my yearly dentist checkup that I thought of two of life's other stressful rituals, finding a job and dating. All three probe my most sensitive areas and test my nervous system. My quest to land that dream job hasn't been that different from my search to find my future wife. After all, both involve the pursuit of a healthy, long-term relationship, and I've leaned on all my connections to help me with both searches. Take, for example, my quest last year for a marketing manager position. To get a leg up, I asked my recruiter whether the position was a straight 9-to-5 job and if it would put me on a professional career track. That very week, a friend introduced me to a successful speech pathologist. On our first date, I did some digging. Does she side with Bush or Clinton? More importantly, is she okay with Indian food? Crucial to any interview or date is the first impression. At my interview, a firm handshake and neatly tailored Burberry suit had me off and running. Then the questions started, those seemingly innocuous open-ended ones that supposedly have no wrong answers. What are your career goals? What are your strengths, your weaknesses? They remind me of the questions that come up on a first date. Questions like, where do you see yourself in 10 years? Translation, is this guy marriage material? Answer correctly, and you're likely to get a call back for a second date. Then there's accounting for that six-month gap in your work experience. It surfaces both in your dating past and on your resume. In a job interview, you turn that not-so-great idea you had to push vacation tours in Costa Rica into a period of serious soul-searching. On a date, it's a challenge to explain the absence of any meaningful relationship since the Clinton administration. In a perfect world, I'd know after an interview whether I had the job or not. But being hired on the spot is as likely as getting the corner office. And with dating, I also find I have trouble gauging what will happen next. Inevitably, I play the waiting game. After the job interview, I sent the obligatory thank you note. But a week passed and no word. The recruiter explained that I'm one of several candidates and the company will notify me shortly. Meanwhile, the speech pathologist tells me she's busy next week, but that she'll call me soon to make plans. Days go by. Nothing. Both my date and the interview demand a similar analysis. Did I ask intelligent questions? Did I have food stuck between my teeth? And I wonder, will I get a call back? Was I too forward? Was it my shirt? Eventually, I find another marketing job opening. Sadly, however, there's no news to report on the dating front. I've already put my next dental appointment on the calendar. At least my dentist doesn't mince words. With him, I know where I stand. And for better or worse, our relationship could well outlast my next job and my next girlfriend.
In addition to having excellent teeth, Scott Crady is gainfully employed as a freelance writer. He lives in New York City. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakravarti, Eileen Imada, Julie Jopp, Chris O'Connor, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog, with help from Sarah Cook and John Parati. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.